Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. We're really pleased you're able to make it. I'm Charles Eichenbaum from the Microsoft Azure team. I've got one of our experts, Jason Clark, Technical Product Manager for Azure, with us today for our discussion on the basics of getting started with Microsoft Azure, specifically storage, networking, and compute. We'll start out with a presentation from Jason, which will include a live demo of virtual machines, and then a Q&A session at the end. Feel free to submit any question you have as we go, and we'll answer as many possible at the end. We'll also be sending out a recording and the slides after the event. And with that, I'll hand it over to Jason.
Hey, good morning, folks. Thank you for joining us this morning. My name is Jason Clark. I'm a technical product manager for Azure, particularly focused on infrastructure as a service. So this morning, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be going through a look at some of the basics of getting started with infrastructure as a service, and that basically boils down to looking at storage, network, and compute features and functions and talking about how we can utilize those to address business needs in your environment. So without further ado, what I'd like to do is just start to set the scene a little bit. So essentially what I'd like to do in this session is give you a background as to how we've arrived at our infrastructure services today. And that context allows us to have a look at how we're progressing the infrastructure services and the trajectory of releases that we'll be talking about going forward. I think one of the best ways, so once we've done that, we will drill down deeply into storage, network, and compute features, talking about things like blob storage and high availability and VNet to VNet connections, and I'll explain all of those terms as we go along. But I always think it's really useful to just take a step back and understand the context of the discussion that we're having this morning. And so what you can see in front of me is a slide that I sort of made to provide us with the context of how we've arrived at this position that we're in today. And so what we see on the left-hand side is this thing called I.O. And for those of you who are not aware of it, I.O. from a Microsoft perspective is infrastructure optimization. It's the process by which we evolve technologies to deliver a business benefit around system center and virtualization and around data center management. And so this is a process that was developed by Gartner and MIT back in the early 1990s, and it's something that really talks to how we think about the new features and functions that we might be releasing in any product cycle. And so it's a measure of maturity of your infrastructure, and it allows us to make implications for what it costs you to manage and maintain that infrastructure. I'm not going to go too far into the detail of infrastructure optimization because this is an Azure session, but as you can imagine, one element of Azure is a hybrid cloud scenario. So it means moving from that data center on-premise that is virtualized and highly managed and highly automated, and then how do I progress those services to further reduce costs by consuming Azure services. And so what you can see here is that we've been working along this infrastructure optimization process, and if we had time, I could go through how System Center releases have shown you how we can, you know, optimize your infrastructure. So for those of you who might be a little bit aware, you know, in System Center Configuration Manager in 2003, we didn't have operating system deployment. So how did OSD get into there? Well, we needed to help you optimize your infrastructure by delivering a single SOE to desktops, and that's where the deployment features within Config Manager came from. So if you talk about that as a holistic process in data centers, we've been doing that for the last 15 years. And then all of a sudden along came cloud. So the private cloud, the service provider hosted cloud, or the public cloud. Doesn't matter which one. And those are very much of a disruptive force to the process that we've been going along and that all organizations have been going along in terms of optimizing their in-house data centers. But the great news about cloud is being a disruptive force is that it enables us to take a step back and talk about IT as a service, infrastructure or IT as a service. When I use that word service, the first thing that I imply is an agreement between a consumer on the left and a producer on the right. So from a public cloud perspective, the consumer could be any business that's out there, and the producer would be either Azure or a service provider. But you can look at it also from a private cloud perspective and say that you as your internal IT department have an agreement with the business to deliver services. And when we look at that agreement, That agreement is largely broken down into four sections. Infrastructure foundations, so think about storage, network, and compute. Those are the basic elements of your infrastructure. How do you manage that infrastructure? And then how do applications live on top of that infrastructure? And then how do I monitor the availability, reliability, and performance of that infrastructure or those services that are applied on that infrastructure? And so when we look at that agreement, the whole point of that agreement is that it is enable, or we are able to implement that agreement through Windows Server 2012 R2, System Center 2012 R2, and Azure. So that's really the context of the discussion. Let's go and have a little bit of a look at what that overall strategy looks like from a Microsoft perspective. For those of you who I'm pretty interested in architecture, and I found a way to sort of explain our strategy across those three types of clouds and talk to you about the unique benefit that Microsoft has. And it's some of the things that you may touch on as you start to explore Azure. So let's go and have a look at this. For those of you who don't know, this is the Marina Bay Sands Hotel in Singapore. And the reason I chose this, obviously, is because it's got three pillars. But more importantly, because of the boat that's across the top. That boat is actually a series of bars and swimming pools and everything else like that. But the importance of the boat and the span across the top, essentially, is that it holds those three pillars together. And uniquely, that is the Microsoft benefit when we talk about how we provide services across private cloud, so on-premise, the data center at the end of the corridor in your building, how we work with service providers or hosters to provide cloud services where there may not be an Azure data center or where there may be an imperative, say, for example, that you may be living in Australia and you don't, there's regulation that says you can't move your data outside of Australia. Although we do have a data center in Australia announced at the moment, prior to that, we would have worked with service providers to be able to allow us to connect the on-premise private cloud to the service provider cloud. But obviously, we also have Azure and what we're talking about today. Now, the unique part about the Microsoft strategy across all of these things is the things that bind them together. And in many ways, in the same way that this building, the three pillars of this building, would each independently fall over if they weren't bound by the components across the top, the same is true for our strategy when we talk about cloud. The strength and the unique benefit that Microsoft has across against any of its competitors is the fact that we see cloud as a and discussion, not an or discussion. And what I mean by that is if you're Amazon or Google, the only thing that you do is public cloud. That's what you sell, and that's how you define your services. And in fact, it is against your business model and against what you're trying to achieve by having any private cloud. But we don't see the world that way. We don't see it in that sort of very binary, you can either have this or this. We see it on the fact that most customers have got a private cloud or they've got a data center that needs to be evolved into a private cloud. And they want to extend those data centers and start to utilize cloud services as they meet their business requirements and as those technologies mature. And the benefit of being able to consume any cloud model, irrespective of where the service actually lives, is the unique benefit. And we achieve that by the components that bind us together. So what I mean by that is Active Directory. You know, we all know that we've got Active Directory. We've got Active Directory on-premise, so in this area here. That's the same Active Directory that everybody uses today. We use Active Directory and Federation for service providers, and Active Directory for public cloud. So we've got Windows Azure Active Directory, and we'll talk about that when we talk about identity management a little bit later. There's a common framework. What that really means is that you could, if you think about it, if you had a network that was connected to your private cloud, you could authenticate to Active Directory from your computer, and then you could consume a public cloud service with single sign-on. And that public cloud service is federated with 4,000 other service providers like Salesforce or whomever. So you could have single sign-on across your applications by virtue of the fact that you have common identity. There's common virtualization. I use VHD format on private cloud, service provider cloud, and public cloud. And what that really means for us is that we're able to move virtual machines across any one of these models or these cloud environments without the needing the need to shut down, change it from, let's say, VMDK to VHD, all of the time that it might take to do that whilst you've got an interruption to service. So by virtue of the fact that in many ways we're talking about a similar file system across all things, that really enables real scenarios like bursting into the cloud on the basis of a threshold violation that is detected in your private cloud or something like that. There's common management. We use System Center to manage private clouds. We use the same version of System Center to manage service provider clouds, and the same version of System Center is used to manage Azure. So you've got a common management framework, and that allows you to view your infrastructure, irrespective of whether it sits in the private, the service provider, or the public cloud, as one entity. And then finally, a common development environment. Basically, what that means is if I write a application on my desktop over here, I can publish it to any one of these clouds, and it will take advantage of the scale-up and scale-out features that are provided within that management framework to be able to consume resources on demand. And so you may have seen you may have seen this as something called the Cloud OS. Okay, that's the marketing term that we have come, that we've developed in order to tell the story around how we enable these three primary components of cloud services. So I just wanted to take that little bit of time to talk to you about the overall strategy and what makes focusing today in terms of public cloud service really important is that ultimately those public cloud services and consumption that you make can be connected to whatever, wherever your environment sits today, at the least cost of owning that infrastructure and with the least amount of integration. So that's just an important underlying principles around the Microsoft cloud structure. So how do we get you? Well, it's been a pretty long story for us. When we talk about Azure as a public cloud service, we actually started with this concept of platform as a service, PaaS. Today this session is focused on infrastructure as a service. And that largely speaks to, you know, who owns what and who manages what. So if you think about it from an infrastructure as a service perspective, when you log on to the Azure portal and you fire up a virtual machine, we manage everything in our data centers from the hardware, the networking, the storage, all the way up through to the hypervisor. And you own and manage your operating system and the application that lives on that. In a PaaS environment, we own the hardware, the operating systems, we manage the hypervisor, we manage SQL Server, let's say, for example, and you manage the data. And so that's the distinction between infrastructure as a service in terms of the basics of providing virtual machines, storage and network and compute, to providing platform as a service, which is a lower cost of owning that infrastructure. So you pay us a bit more for that, but you don't have to worry about updating operating systems and patching hypervisors or anything like that. We do that for you. So we actually started on that right-hand side, that platform as a service. And we started that, to give you a little bit of a background, we actually started that discussion way back in the early 1990s with a chap by the name of Ray Ozzie. And they looked at this and they said, look, guys, when we're trying to deploy very large services, you know, we want to move away from this environment where you've got the SQL Server hugger or the Exchange Server hugger, the person that is the administrator for the Exchange or SQL environment in your companies, and that person can walk into the data center, they can point to a server, and they can say, that's the SQL Server, and that's what I do, that's what I manage. But when we want to scale those out to, let's say, 50,000 computers, how is that one person going to be able to manage that? And so in terms of being able to deploy large-scale services at the least cost in terms of owning the infrastructure and managing it, platform as a service is absolutely the way to go. So if you're writing new code today and you're writing new applications today, there is absolutely no doubt that platform as a service is the easiest and cheapest way to develop that application, publish it, and then run it in production. There's no doubt about that. But what about those workloads that you don't want to rewrite or that can't operate in a platform as a service environment? How do I decide what workloads and what things I can actually move to the public cloud? And so what you see here in front of you on the slide is the trajectory of how we developed platform as a service. So in 2007, we started a project called Project Red Dog. Interestingly enough, when I show you the portal later, that's still known internally as the RDFE or the Red Dog front end. So it still maintains that name from a legacy perspective. But essentially, they started with Project Red Dog, and then they started to onboard all of these other services so that people could bring new applications to the platform as a service. So you can see in 2008, they started with something called the web and the worker role. And I'll talk to you a little bit about that in a while when I demonstrate it. The web and the worker role is, how do I quickly fire up a large-scale website that is public-facing for a particular campaign that I might have or whatever the case may be? Then in 2009, we started with PHP and Java support. In 2010, Azure became RTM. In November 2010, we came up with full support for IIS and remote desktop and some other features. And then in 2011, some further features with new versions of languages like Java and so on. And then it was only actually in 2013 that we started with infrastructure as a service. And that, if you think about that story, all of this, the top line there is, how do I get platform as a service applications into Azure? And what are the on-ramps? What are the features that I can hook into, like remote desktop or IIS or Java, that will allow me to do that? And in the same way, that's how you should think about infrastructure as a service. It is really there to say, how do I take what cannot be rewritten, or which currently works on a single VM and doesn't operate in a PaaS environment, and how do I take advantage of the lowest cost compute, storage, and network environment to move that application to the cloud? And that's really where infrastructure as a service started. So you can see from that date that it's just over a year old in terms of RTM. Obviously, we've had previews of features and functions before that. So I just wanted to give you that context. I'm going to break out of the slides now and just quickly go to the Azure portal itself. And the reason I'm going to do that is because the next series of slides that I'm just showing you here just outline the fact that that Azure is not one thing. It has four primary categories of services, and let me just show you what those are quickly. So this is the Azure portal that I'm logged into. You'll notice that I'm logged into, at the top right-hand corner here, you'll notice that I'm logged into the Azure portal with my Microsoft ID, and that shows you that this is single sign-on. Now, if I go to the Azure portal here and I go to documentation, you'll notice that there are four primary branches of services: compute, data services, application services, and networking services. I'm not going to go through each and every one of those particular components today. I'm mostly going to be focusing on some of the compute functions like virtual machines, cloud services, websites, but I am going to look at some of the data services like storage and some of the networking services like virtual networks and traffic manager, and I'll explain what each one of these features and functions are. And so what that makes you start to think about Azure-like is a little bit like a box of Lego. Imagine that you've got a box of Lego in front of you, and each one of these little blue things like virtual machines or cloud services or data services like cache is a little Lego block, a unique Lego block. And you want to decide how to assemble, to look into that box. You've got a business need, you've got a problem that you need a public cloud service to address. Then really what you want to go through here is understand these services and decide how you want to bring those services together and build up your application or your solution to a particular business problem. And so what you see on my slides here is I've basically just gone in there and pulled out each of the components under computes and so on, and I've just explained what each one of them are, what each one of them is. So I'll take a quick tour through that, and then we'll drill down into the infrastructure as a service side of things. So virtual machines are like virtual machines that you've got on any virtual environment, and I'll show you the scale and the quantity of virtual machines that we've got within our gallery that you can start at any time. So websites are a PaaS service, a platform as a service service, and essentially, as I said to you earlier, that's just a way of starting a starting a cloud service that contains web and worker roles, so front-end and back-end servers for a web environment. So you could think that you might have two front-end servers that are load balanced, so that if one breaks or goes down or needs to be patched, the other one takes over the role, and you have a continuation of services. And then you might have, 10 SharePoint servers behind that where all the data is and so on. So that's essentially websites. Mobile services is really a way for us to be able to develop on Azure applications that can be downloaded and installed and published onto iOS, Apple, Windows 8 phones. So you can use mobile services within Azure to write an app, to write a mobile app and publish it to any kind of carrier and any kind of consumer. Cloud services are something that I will explain in a minute. It's actually a technical definition for what happens when you start a virtual machine in Azure. It immediately creates a cloud service. And if you think about it, you can think about a cloud service like a container, and that container is a boundary of security and communication. And we'll talk a little bit more detail about that in a while. Moving now on to data services, obviously we've got storage services, and we'll talk to you about how storage services work within Azure. So you'll know that we have persistent and non-persistent disks, and they are, all that information is held in something called blob storage or binary large object storage, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that. Essentially, the primary difference between infrastructure as a service and platform as a service is that in platform as a service, we have non-persistent disks, whereas in infrastructure as a service, we have persistent disks. For those of you who come from a virtual environment, it's like saving a virtual machine difference file versus when you reboot a virtual machine, you completely lose that disk in terms of platform as a service. We've got SQL databases. Obviously, SQL Azure is a very important component. You can fire up SQL in both an infrastructure as a service or a highly available platform as a service environment with SQL always on. HD Insight is Microsoft's Hadoop big data solution. It's an Apache 2 compliant big data service. Then we move on to some further services. Caching, for those of you who can remember proxy server, essentially that's what caching does. If you think about it, there is massive backbones connecting all of the Azure data centers globally. And let's say you had a global ad campaign, you can publish data to all of your caching services across the globe, and that way people have local access and quicker response times to the data that you're trying to publish globally. Recovery service is something that I actually will focus on specifically in this discussion, because it's the ability to take, you consider this the proposition of being able to take or right mouse click over a virtual machine in VMM, so an on-premise implementation of Hyper-V, right mouse click that and back that up to Azure. So it's literally taking snapshots and Delta replications of a VHD and placing it directly into Azure as a disaster recovery environment. So that's the data services. Moving on to application services, we've got media services. So media services, for those of you who maybe aren't aware, the Sochi Olympics was actually streamed using Microsoft Media Services. So we had, I think, 42 direct feeds, live feeds from Sochi. They were all consolidated into a private cloud. So all of those feeds came into a private cloud in Seattle here. And then it was that information was pumped up to Azure. And there was 1,000 instances of virtual machines that were doing all of the encoding to 1080p and the various different technologies that are required to stream live video to different types of devices, whether they be mobile, whether they be TV and the different standards across different countries, and so on. So those media services were used for encoding. Another element of media service is something called the content delivery network, which is how do I use that massive backbone to stream that data out rather than using my own connections. And so that's something that we have internally as well. Other application services include things like service bus. Service buses are there for to be able to connect loose applications together. So applications that don't necessarily directly communicate, like when you drag and drop something from one application to another application on your desktop, you're actually using something called NetDDE or Network Dynamic Data Exchange as a protocol to swap that information out. And that's a common language between the two windows. But what happens if those windows didn't actually speak that common language? How could you bind or drag and drop across two separate windows? Well, you would have to have a service that took data in one format and pumped it out into another format and connected it to that application. And that's essentially what the service bus and things like BizTalk services do. Notification hubs are ways in which you can publish data out to applications, again, both on desktops, mobile phones, whatever the case may be. And it means that that little piece of toast pops up in the right-hand side of your bottom right-hand side of your screen, like when you receive a new email or someone's trying to IM you. So we are able to connect those notification hubs to it. I talked a bit about BizTalk services already. Active Directory, clearly we've got Active Directory in the cloud. And so through Windows Active Directory Premium, as I explained earlier, you can have things like single sign-on. So you have an identity that is managed, that is up in the cloud that enables you to synchronize passwords and identity across multiple different service providers. And one of the benefits of something like single sign-on, it is also coupled to something called multi-factor authentication. And remember, you've got your little secure ID, you log on to a service and it asks you for your secure ID PIN. Well, imagine that when I go to log on to the Azure portal with my username and password, the next thing that happens is my phone rings with an SMS message with a little with a little sequence of numbers, which I then type in before I've got access to my Azure portal. And then finally, the networking features that we've got that we will talk about at length as we drill down into the infrastructure as a service components is the ability to connect cloud services together through virtual networks and point-to-site and point-to-point networks. And then Traffic Manager, which is like a global network load balancing, it allows you to have global endpoints in different Azure data centers and redirect traffic to the most likely utilized node of that service. And then I've already mentioned what a content delivery network actually is. So let's see how that manifests itself when we then focus on Azure. So just to summarize up to this point, what I've done is outlined the three components of the cloud strategy of Microsoft: the public, the service provider, and the private cloud services. I've then drilled into what Azure is actually made up of and the fact that it's like a box of Lego. And as we try to generate or fix a particular problem in our business, we would use things like some of the data services, some of the storage services, and we would bring those together to architect a solution to our particular problem. So let's just have a quick look at what that looks like. Now, I know that most of you have actually got Azure accounts and that you've signed on, but just for those of you who haven't, just to give you a brief look at some of the features and functions of the Azure portal, I'll just go back to how easy it is to create a virtual machine, what a cloud service is, what VNets are, and we'll talk to you a little bit in detail about what those are at the moment. Let me just refresh this. Okay, well, that's not behaving itself, so while it fires up, let's go and focus on infrastructure as a service. Okay, so I'll come back to demonstrating a couple of things in a minute. Let's go and start now to drill down deeply into what infrastructure as a service actually is and what features and functions it provides. The slide that you're seeing now is really a slide that outlines the ethos behind how we developed our infrastructure as a service. So notice the orange bit at the bottom. It says, if it requires a developer, it's not IaaS. So if somebody has to write code to get this to work, then it's not infrastructure as a service, it's platform as a service. So the tenets of Windows Azure IaaS are, it's an IT pro experience. It's an experience that is designed to appeal to those people who are used to working with things like Hyper-V, with SANs, with LUNs, with storage, all of the infrastructure services that we lay down in our data center in order to build applications that generate revenue from for our businesses. We need to be able to support key server applications like IIS, like SQL Server, like Exchange, and those components. And there's a rolling release of support for those features. We must make storage easy to manage. And one of the key things that's quite important about the way we've implemented storage is that all of the tools that you use today, like Windows Explorer, will work on Azure Storage. It's essentially a similar, same file system as SMB. NTFS, not SMB. Got myself confused there. So easy storage, high availability features. We must be able to guarantee SLA. And in order to be able to do that, what I'm going to talk about is fault domains, update domains, and how we've actually architected our data center to allow infrastructure as a service to be highly available, so a single machine that will never be out of service or offer five nines capability. We need to have advanced networking, and clearly we need to be able to control traffic in the cloud. We need to be able to decide which components speak to each other, which cloud services speak to each other, and which cloud services speak back to my data center. We need to be able to configure what ports cloud services are listening to the internet for, and so on. So we'll be talking about some of those features. And then integration with compute PaaS, i.e. PaaS and IaaS actually live on the same platform in the same data centers. So we must be able to coexist that. And that's a really important story for when we talk to our competitors in many ways. So Amazon Web Services has got a great IaaS story, but not really a good PaaS story. Google's got a good PaaS story, but not really an IaaS story. And we believe that Azure has a great IaaS and a great PaaS story. So it's, again, the power of and when we're talking about how we provide and think about the services that we are going to be delivering. Okay, and again, the primary tenants and the primary things that people talk to us about is they say, look, we're interested in Azure, but you must be able to integrate with what we've got on-premise at the moment. You must be able to support not just Windows, but Linux and Unix and other operating systems running on top of your Hyper-V hypervisor. And very importantly, we must be able to trust the level of security and all of the compliance issues within your service. And so as we drill down, we will focus on these components as important tenants of the Azure environment. Let me just go and see if my portal's back up. Yep, there's my portal. And so let's talk about how we might go through and create a new virtual machine. So it allows us to talk about some of that high availability features. It allows us to talk about some of the cross-platform Unix, Linux, Windows virtual machines and the galleries that we've got. So the quickest way to get started with Azure is just to go to New, and then we go to New Compute, and I'm going to go to Virtual Machine. And I'm not going to do a quick create. If you think about it, for those of you who've got a background in deployment, essentially what you're doing here, if I go to the Quick Create feature, is I'm just filling in an answer file, which is then going to be injected into the VHD as it's instantiated. But I'm going to go from Gallery because it exposes a few more features to us in terms of starting Windows Service. So first of all, these are all of the images that we actually place up in Azure and support. So obviously we've got Windows Server and Data Center, but what I want to point out to you, obviously the SQL Server, what I'd like to point out to you is some of the Linux components. So we've got Ubuntu, we've got CentOS, we've got SUSE, we've got Oracle that's supported, we've got Puppet components and Chef, and then you've got your ability to bring your own images, so any VHDs that you've snapshotted in your internal environment, you can upload here and then sysprep and clone in the same way that all of these are sysprepped images down the right here. So clearly I'm going to choose a very, and just to talk about the fact that one of the tenets was that you must be able to support our primary workloads, their SharePoint, SQL, BizTalk, and other services as we add and extend those features and functions. So I'm going to clearly choose the best operating system. I'm going to go with Windows Server 2012 R2 as the operating system that I want to choose. It just tells me when it was released. I've got to give the virtual machine a name. Now, that virtual machine name must be unique within my cloud service. Notice also I can go basic or standard. This is something that's basically in preview at the moment, the basic instance of our machine. And a basic instance is a very small virtual machine with no load balancer. Just be aware of that, that there's no load balancer. Sorry. So when I choose a standard virtual machine, I can choose the size of the virtual machines that I want to instantiate. So I can choose A7 with 8 cores and 56 gigabytes. There is new 8 and 9, which goes up to 32 cores and 132 gigs of RAM as well, if I recall those stats correctly. So I'm just going to choose a very small size virtual machine. Obviously, the bigger the machine, the bigger its capacity, the more it's going to cost. The username and password is the administrator's username and password. So it will enforce password complexity. So checking there, you notice that it's got a complex username and password. I go next. Now, in this case, I can create a new cloud service, or I can put my virtual machine into an existing cloud service. Now, remember, a cloud service is like a network boundary. So, for example, I could have a front-end cloud service and a back-end cloud service, and then configure controls as to what is allowed to talk between those two cloud services. So if I have to give the cloud service a name, a DNS name. Notice that it ends with cloudapp.net. You can bring your own DNS services in there. Notice that it's saying that this is not a unique name for my machine. So I'm just going to keep adding it one there until I have a unique name, a unique DNS name. I can then choose the data center that I want to put it into. So in this case, I'm going to put it into East US 2, just for the hell of it. You can choose your own data centers in your own regions. I'm going to create a new existing, generate a new storage account. So a storage account is what is used to bind to your disks to your virtual machine. Now, an availability set. If I put it into an availability set, what you can see here that I'm doing is I'm creating a single virtual machine. I'll talk to you a little bit about availability sets in a minute, but what I'm doing here, if I choose to place this virtual machine in the availability set, I'm actually cloning this virtual machine and I'm putting it on another rack somewhere else in the data center so that if there is an entire rack failure or router failure or power failure, my virtual machine will immediately start on another and there's a clone of it on another set of machines. It also helps us when we need to patch the hypervisor so that you can take down one of your virtual machines and still keep your service running, patch that virtual hypervisor, bring it back up, and shut down your other machine so that you maintain a high availability of service. Then down here in the protocol section, I can choose by default, these are the two protocols that I can use to access my virtual machine. Obviously, I need RDP, so I can RDP to that virtual machine, and I need to be able to execute PowerShell commands against it. I can choose many other endpoints depending on how I want that virtual machine to actually be able to be accessed, depending on the protocol, and again, you can enter your own values. And so this is something called port forwarding, which we'll touch on in advanced networking. So I'm going to create an availability set, and again, I'm just going to give it a name so that it's not unique. Let's see if it's... Let's put something that's unique. I believe that's unique. Okay. Virtual machine configuration. I want to install the VM agent, or I want to use extensions from Puppet and Chef. At this moment, we're not going to go into that detail. That's time for another discussion, but that's the ability to manage and operate and automate Linux and Unix machines. So at that point, I'm not going to bother. I'm just going to start the virtual machine, and it'll take about 2.5 minutes to actually essentially now copy that VHD into my blob storage, inject the VM agent into it, and start that virtual machine on my network. And that's really as simple as it is in terms of starting virtual machines or instantiating a virtual machine. And the same would be true for Linux or Unix or your own virtual machine. So let's go back now into the slides and start to focus in a little bit on some of these detailed features that we talked about. So as I said, Azure is really like a box of Lego with all of these different components that are available to you in order for us to be able to extend and create services. So it's about bringing those things together. And if we had time, I could talk to you about some specifics in relation to how I might assemble those pieces to develop a scenario, but that might be for another session. So let's just make sure we understand the difference between IaaS and PaaS. So first of all, the primary difference is what you see up here in terms of what I've highlighted in the worker role and the non-persistent disks. Okay, so that's the essential. Essentially what I'm saying is when I fire up a virtual machine in IaaS, and I, let's say like I've just done there with Windows 2012 R2, and I install Exchange on that machine, and then I shut it down, and then restart it, Exchange will be installed on it, and it will maintain that different disk. Whereas virtual machines that run on a PaaS environment, they don't maintain that install, because quite clearly we've installed SQL, and we manage up through that SQL layer, so we don't need to maintain the persistence of that disk. It's just the data terminate stay resident, the SQL.exe process, is executing in the cloud. So let's just go off that again. So I've talked to you about what, and I've created the virtual machine. I've talked to you about the images that are in there, open source, as well as Windows Server. I don't know if anybody was attending Build or was watching any of the Build stuff 2 weeks ago, but certainly it was really great to see a lot of the tweets and acknowledgements in terms of how cool it is that to see a open source operating system being managed and integrated by Puppet and Chef with Windows Server and System Center running on an Azure platform. I think that really gained a lot of mind share around the true openness of Microsoft in terms of supporting multiple workloads. As we said, we need to support our own services and applications, and this is some of the components that are currently in validation and some of the applications that you can install on an infrastructure as a service virtual machine, and if for some reason the service breaks or your install breaks, you can still use your support contract to gain assistance from Microsoft. So let's get into these web and worker roles and so on at the moment, so that we can explain some of the things of cloud services. Okay, so just to start off with, a cloud service, when I created that virtual machine right now, you will notice that I didn't actually create a cloud service. But if I went back and looked at the detail in the Azure portal, I would see a cloud service that was wrapped around that virtual machine that I created. What you're seeing in front of you here is actually a PaaS deployment with those front-end VMs as being web roles and the back-end VMs being worker roles. So if you think about what I've just done, I have now a cloud service with one VM in it. Okay, not very useful at the moment, but if I created another VM and put that into that cloud service, all VMs in a cloud service can immediately speak ICMP and communicate between each other, so they can ping each other within a cloud service. When you want to combine multiple cloud services together, what you need to do is create a VNet or virtual network between those two components. And that gives you the ability to segregate traffic, to define security environments, but also to layer application deployment. So these are roles within, and these are instances. So the cloud service can contain multiple roles and multiple instances of each of those roles. So this is what this is the example of what I just did. It contains exactly one virtual machine and it can't really do much. Then I can put another virtual machine in, and those virtual machines within the cloud service can automatically speak to each other. Now if you imagine that I had a data center off to the left of this, and I wanted to be able to ping from my data center directly through to these virtual machines, then I would need to create a virtual network between this cloud service and my on-premise location. Okay? Now, for those of you, one of the newer features that has been just released or announced is something called, internally it was called Golden Gate, but you will see it on the Express in the portal as ExpressRoute. And that means that you can have an MPLS connection directly from the Azure data center that hosts these cloud services and virtual machines directly into your data center, so that you're not going out over the internet to the Azure portal. So that obviously talks to that ability to extend your data center, to start to look at how you purchase hardware within your data center around storage, network, and compute, and decide whether that's cheaper to run and instantiate inside an Azure environment, and then connect your MPLS network to that. So we talked a little bit about disks. Notice that you have got OS disks and then data disks. And obviously the difference, as I explained, between IaaS and PaaS is that the OS disk is persistent in IaaS, but it's not in PaaS. Okay? So as I say, with virtual machine sizes, talks to you about the size of memory and the cores and the number of IOPS that you can get from that. Obviously, we've got an A7 and an A8, an A8 and an A9 instance size now, which takes the cores up to 32 and the memory up to 132 gigs per virtual machine. And obviously, you can combine as many of those together. And that's essentially what media services do. They combine a whole lot of these virtual machines together to do the coding and encoding of data as it moves in and out of the data center through the Azure media services. So yeah, I won't go through disk caching at the moment. So images in Azure are stored in something called binary large object blocks. Data is immediately triplicated. So every time you copy a virtual machine into Azure, you've immediately got three copies of it. And this is to establish SLAs and keep redundant copies of making sure that the data is never lost. That data is encrypted, and it also allows you to BYO your own encryption by exposing the crypto API. The same is true for networking through things like Cisco and Big IP5 and all of those sorts of things. You can bring your own hardware load balancers and so on to these applications in order to be able to adjust that. So just to show you, one of the things I talked about was the ability to back up Windows services and VHDs directly to Windows Azure. So essentially you sign up for the service, you install the agent, and then you right mouse click over the Windows server and VMM. And obviously, you've created a VNet between your Windows Azure subscription and your data center, and then you're able to back up those encrypted data. And you can do that either on a single instance by single instance, or you can get all of your virtual machines to report to a DPM server, and then get DPM to back directly up, or Data Protection Manager within the System Center suite to back up to Windows Azure. And that's what you see here with the backup agent, I believe, in the next slide. Yeah, so that's DPM. And obviously, you are always able to keep your own encryption key. That's never owned by us. So we can't even decrypt your data. It's inside your own blob, so that talks to the security features. All right, so now we talk about how we establish our 5.9s and our 3.9s uptime and service level agreements, where if we don't meet these, we'll start paying you, essentially. So what's included and what's not included? Let's go and have a look. Something called an availability set, and that's what you saw me create. An availability set basically means that I have two instances of the same virtual machine, and physically they are going to be located in different parts of the Azure data center that have their own power supplies, their own backup power supplies, their own routers, backup routers, and so on, so that in case one virtual machine or one rack fails or top of rack router fails, you've still got access to your application through an availability set. Now, those availability sets will always span fault domains and update domains. A fault domain is a designated rack, and an update domain is also a rack. It's essentially saying that all of the machines in this rack are an update domain, which means that when I need to update the hypervisor or provide a patch for that hypervisor, I'm going to shut all those virtual machines down. I'm not going to guarantee availability on that single rack. And so if we look at the diagram, it might help to explain. So this is literally what a rack looks like in the data center. And what we're saying is there's a power unit for the rack switch. And what we are saying is that an availability set really spans the VMs across those racks. So in the example of web roles and worker roles, you can see I've got four instances of web role and four instances of a worker role. And what I've now got is those instances are maintained in separate racks, and each of those racks is a fault domain, and each of those instances within those racks is an update domain. So that makes sure that when I take down rack one on the left, your service is still running on rack two, and that's just simply by ticking that box that says place my virtual machine into an availability set. Okay, so that's what we've got there, the racks, availability sets, fault domains, as we've described. Networking, and I'm going a bit quick because I know we've got 5 minutes and I want to make sure that there's 5 minutes for questions at the end. So you can bring your own DNS servers so that you can use your own name resolution components. As you saw, when I created a virtual machine, it called it test11111.cloudapp.net, but you might want to call it contoso.com or whatever the case may be, in which case you can then bring your own DNS environments. Protocols and endpoints, protocols that are supported within a Windows Azure cloud service. Obviously, all IP, UDP packets. We've got port forwarding so that you can configure a listener for a particular socket, which is a IP address and a port number, so that I can configure my web role to listen on port 8080 and then forward it internally to port 80 on the web role. And that's what you see here. So important difference between establishing a application in IaaS and PaaS is that in PaaS, an availability set almost always means that you've got a load balancer, whereas in IaaS you don't. You have to actually go and create the load balancer and put it into a load balance set, but it's just one extra step. So essentially what you can see is that I've configured my load balancer to listen on port 5586 for this particular TCP traffic, and then it's going to port forward that to port 3389 across the load balancer for my VMs that are hosting that application. And that's by default, and you can scale those up and scale those out. So we've got availability sets, load balancers, and when we combine those features, essentially we can guarantee 5 nines in terms of, or 99.95% uptime, which I thought it was like 4 hours downtime a year. So there are custom probes built into the load balancer, but again, remember you can bring your own software load balancers here, and there is a health check.aspx probe that essentially determines which machine is overloaded or which machine is not working, and then reroutes traffic within those load balancers. So clearly that gives us the ability now to therefore connect on-site to enterprise through things called point-to-site and site-to-site VNets. This is particularly useful for test dev scenarios. Consider that you might have a group of people situated globally that need to collaborate on a particular test environment that they're developing. You can give them a point-to-site VPN, which will essentially download an RDP file which allows them to connect to that cloud service and that unique set of VMs only and never access your internal environment. You can give site-to-site internet access, and that's essentially what you would need from your data center to a cloud service in order to be able to ping it, like I said. And that obviously enables things like branch offices and so on. I'm not going to go through the details of essentially what I've just explained here, which is how you use point-to-site and site-to-site connections to create VNets between on-premise and your cloud services, which you've instantiated. In this case, there's three cloud services, two VNets between them, and a VNet between the CorpNet, and so on. We won't go through the relative strengths and disadvantages. There's strengths and disadvantages to implementing VNet to VNet or point-to-site or site-to-site VNet, but that's really based upon a clear understanding of what the workload and outcome is all about. So merely talking about the feature as opposed to when you would use and how you would instantiate that feature. So that's the session. Let me just wrap up before we get to any questions. So hopefully what we were able to talk about today was give you an understanding of what Microsoft's cloud strategy across its entire scope of clouds are, be they private service provider or public cloud like Azure, what that overall strategy means for the type of things that you can do, how that strategy is bound together by common identity management, development, and one other one, I'll get that in a minute. So we looked at that. Then we said, okay, let's have a look at what's the difference between IaaS and PaaS. We started with PaaS. Amazon started with IaaS. We're now going to IaaS. We have a great IaaS and PaaS story, not one or the other. We then drill down into what IaaS components specifically are around network, storage, and compute. And we showed you how to create a VM very quickly and how to the basics of how storage works in terms of binary large objects and creating storage accounts and connecting to virtual machines. We talked about networks, advanced network components, about how a cloud service is a boundary of a network configuration, how you can combine cloud services together through VNet, and how you can connect on-premise data centers by site-to-site VNets or point-to-site VNets for a test dev scenario. And we also talked about the VMs that are available in the gallery, both Windows and Linux and Unix, as well as VMs that you can bring yourself. That talks to that and strategy, that not that or strategy. And I think that covers most of the things that we have talked about. So I want to say thank you very much for your time and just open it up to questions at this point.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Jason. We've got a couple questions here, running a little short on time, so we'll try and go quick. First question, if I deploy Azure on-premise private, can I leverage your VM templates, or do I have to start from scratch?
So there's another question to that. So when you're talking about when you you deploy IaaS on-premise, I'm assuming that you're talking there about the Windows Azure pack, that you wrap that around around your data center and your private cloud. And the answer is that you can create runbooks, which can then automate deployment across both physical and Azure data centers. That integration will get stronger and stronger and stronger as you know we're releasing the group that is Windows Server and System Center sit together with the Azure people, and their release, the cadence in terms of software releases, is designed to coincide. Everything is designed or coded cloud first, and then retrospectively placed into on-premise applications. So you'll find that a feature will become available in Azure first, so templates and things like that will become available in Azure first, and then they will be available to be orchestrated from on-premise locations and your on-premise implementation of System Center and Windows Server after a period of time. The short answer is yes, it takes a bit of work.
Great, thanks. And one more question. Please explain Microsoft licensing for software, for example, SQL, the customer uses in Azure Cloud.
Wow, that's a big question. So, I mean, there's multiple ways to consume and pay for Azure. One of the unique benefits that Microsoft has is that through your enterprise agreement and software assurance, one of the benefits that you have is something called license mobility. So today, if you've never consumed an Azure service, but you've paid for SQL or IIS or anything else like that on-premise, you have the right to move that to Azure, whether it be an IaaS or PaaS. You still go, of course, from a licensing perspective, you're not going to pay for the license, but you're still going to pay for the storage, network, and compute element of that. So you're still going to get an Azure bill, but you're not going to be paying for the license of that operating system. I think there's a lot more to that question. It's quite a deep question, so maybe that's something that you've got my email address. If it's something that you would like to talk about, then I'm happy to have an offline conversation if I haven't answered that question completely.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Jason, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. We're really glad you're able to make it. As a reminder, we're going to be sending out the slides and the recording over the next day or two, and thanks, everybody, for your interest in Azure.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.